Okay, we're back in business. So are there any questions about any of this before we go on? Yeah. Well, his question is, answering my question, why is the receptor stimulatory here and inhibitory there? It's the same receptor with the same transacting domain. But what must be happening is there are other transcription factors that are present here, and it is the binding to them that causes stimulation. And there are other different ones in the breast, and the binding to them is what causes inhibition. So it must be some other protein that is responsible for being up versus down regulated. It can't be the receptor itself because the receptor is the same. Why do receptors need to dimerize in order to work? Well, there's a structural answer to that. That they don't bind DNA unless they're dimerized, that their structure is inappropriate for sticking to DNA. We'll see that there are many other proteins that are similar, that they don't work by themselves, that when, in order to be active, they have to combine into multimers. So now what we want to do is consider these G protein-coupled receptors. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say almost everything that's in the notes, but not necessarily quite in the order that it's given there. I had second thoughts after I printed it. So I want to talk about G proteins, but I want to start first by talking very briefly about the G protein-coupled receptors. And probably the easiest way to introduce this is to look at today's handout at 12A. Now, we explained last time sort of how G proteins fit in here to signaling. And this is another schematic version of the pathway we had last time. That you have a receptor in the membrane, and the water-soluble signal comes from the outside and binds to its extracellular domain. And this, in turn, activates what's called a G protein. I'll explain that in a minute. And this, in turn, activates an enzyme. And the enzyme, there's more than one possibility for the enzyme. And there are two examples given here in the two panels on your handout for two different enzymes which carry out different reactions. But the result of this enzyme action will be to generate a molecule in the cytoplasm, what we've called the second messenger. The ligand or hormone is the first messenger, and the enzyme, the small molecule inside, is the second messenger, and the one we talked about last time, which we'll talk about first today, is cyclic AMP. So we're going to talk today about each of the components here, and first I want to say just a word about these receptors. These receptors that are linked to G proteins are all from the same protein family with the same basic structure, and they're all 7-pass transmembrane. Now, this is in contrast to the other major class of receptors for receiving water-soluble signals. These proteins are single-pass proteins, and as we'll see, they also have to dimerize in order to work. Now, we're not going to talk about these at all at length now. We're going to talk about them later. But there's a difference in structure as well as in function, that these are virtually all single pass, and the G protein coupled receptors are all multipass. So when the ligand binds the receptor, the combination is activated and takes on a different conformation. And in that conformation, it binds to the G protein and triggers the activation of the G protein. And that's what I want to talk about next, what a G protein is and how it gets activated. So let's leave that. Now, G proteins are actually involved in many other processes besides signaling, and we've been ignoring them up until now. And G proteins have two forms, active and inactive. And the difference is that the inactive one is attached to GDP, and the active one is attached to GTP, triphosphate. Now, the reason these are called G proteins is it's changes in GTP, GDP that activate and inactivate them, as opposed to proteins which are activated or inactivated by adding phosphates from a kinase. We've talked already about proteins that have two forms, where one is active and one is inactive, and the difference is a phosphate. And the phosphate is put on from ATP using a kinase. Now, in this case, either form of the protein can be the active one. Either we'll see some cases the phosphorylated is the active and the plain is inactive, and some cases it's vice versa. But this difference is achieved by taking a phosphate off of ATP, sticking it onto your enzyme. And we've explained before that this process is reversible using a phosphatase. Now, this is one way of using a nucleotide to switch an enzyme from one form to another. So this uses ATP. G proteins use GTP. But they do it in a different way. Now, if you wanted to convert the GDP version to the GTP version, what is the obvious thing to do? You would think you would just add a phosphate on, say, from ATP, and turn GTP into GDP. But you don't. That's not how it's done. What you do instead is to dump the GDP and pick up a GTP. So let's draw it again. And to make it clearer, I'm going to use two colors. That GTP replaces the GDP. And the GDP is bumped off. So this is called GDP-GTP exchange. Because one nucleotide is switched for the other. Now, this is a catalytic reaction. And the catalyst is basically the G protein itself. The G protein has the enzymatic activity to catalyze exchange. The binding of the activated receptor triggers the enzyme to become active and to switch, dump the GDP, and pick up GTP. And it is this form with the GTP that then activates the next thing in line. In this case, the enzyme. So the activated receptor is the signal to turn on the G protein and have it catalyze exchange. And then the form with the GTP acts as the signal to bind to the enzyme and turn on the enzyme. Now, this is just one part of it. We've just activated our G protein. As a GDP version, it just lies around. But as the GT protein version, it binds to and activates other proteins. But you want signals not to last too long. You want a signal to turn itself off. And it does in this case because This protein also has the enzymatic activity needed to remove the last phosphate and return the protein to its GDP binding in active form. So these enzymes, these G proteins, catalyze two different steps. They catalyze GTP-GDP exchange, and they also catalyze GTP hydrolysis back to GDP. Now, what's the net result of one cycle? Is you pick up GTP, dump GDP, and then later you jump phosphate. So the net effect of one cycle is to split one GTP down to GDP and PI. That is the net effect. And so these enzymes, these proteins are often sometimes called GTPases, because the net result of the two steps is to hydrolyze one GTP. Most of the G proteins involved in signaling are trimeric G proteins. So a G protein has three subunits, an ordinary G protein, which are named alpha, beta, and gamma. And the alpha one is the one that binds GDP or GTP. So in the inactive form, the protein looks like this, the G protein. When GTP comes along and displaces the GDP, the alpha part separates, leaving the beta and the gamma. They remain separate until the GTP is hydrolyzed. Once the GTP is hydrolyzed down to GDP, they get it back together again. Now, the part that's active, that serves as the activator of the next step in line, is either the alpha part or the beta-gamma part, or sometimes both. So either of these can act as the activator of the next guy in line. But after a fairly short time, the enzymatic activity of the alpha subunit returns the GTP to GDP, and then alpha sticks back to beta and gamma, and you have the inactive whole trimeric form. Now, there are other proteins that are called small G proteins, and they look more like this one. A small G protein has no subunits. It is just one subunit. Like the large G proteins, it has its GDP form and its GTP form, inactive, active. Like the other protein, it has the ability to hydrolyze GTP and turn itself off and go back to GDP. So this part it has. But the protein doesn't have the catalytic ability to catalyze GDP-GTP exchange. So in order for a small G protein to be converted to the GTP form, you have to have a separate enzyme to catalyze the exchange part. Now, you don't have to have a separate enzyme for the hydrolase part, for the phosphatase, but it's common to have one anyway to speed up the hydrolysis. So small G proteins generally work along with other proteins to help them, to make them activated and help them deactivate. The most famous small G protein, which you'll hear more about later, is called RAS. This protein is involved in regulation of the cell cycle, and we'll talk about it when we get to that. But the reason we know so much about this protein is a large proportion of cancer cells have mutated RAS. They have something wrong with the gene for this protein, and this protein is aberrant. So we know that you need this protein in order to have proper control of cell growth. And if you mutate this protein, it either causes cancer or contributes to it. And for now, that's all we're going to say about small G proteins, and we're going to go back and look at the big ones. Now, they're actually in signaling several different G proteins, not just one. And each receptor binds to and triggers activation of an appropriate partner G protein. Each G protein, then, depending on which one it is, can either activate or inhibit the next protein in the sequence. And we're going to talk about a couple of different ones. Now, we want to look first at the case we referred to last time. We said, for example, that thyroid stimulating hormone binds to its receptor, which activates a G protein, which activates an enzyme, which causes production of cyclic AMP, and that leads to the activation of all the enzymes to make thyroid hormone. So let's look at that more carefully. That this particular receptor triggers the G protein, which is usually called GS, which is the one that stimulates the enzyme that makes cyclic AMP. So if you look back at your handout again on the top, the enzyme that is activated here by the active G protein is adenyl cyclase, also called adenyl cyclase, usually abbreviated AC. The proper chemical name of this enzyme is probably adenyl cyclase, but it used to be called adenyl cyclase, which is why I sometimes call it one or the other. But it's usually abbreviated AC. And what this enzyme does is to catalyze the conversion of ATP into cyclic AMP, and then the cyclic AMP acts as a second messenger within the cell. Now, what is cyclic AMP? That's drawn on the bottom of your handout. Where it says ATP, adenyl cyclase, goes to cyclic AMP. Now, what is it? If you have ATP or AMP, you have adenine linked to ribose. And then if this were plain old ATP, you'd have phosphate, phosphate, phosphate. But what happens is you knock off the two N phosphates, and the remaining phosphate now provides a link between the 5' position and the 3' position. So there's a phosphate in here. And this is cyclic AMP. And it is used as a messenger in many different organisms and in many different contexts. We're going to focus on one. Because in your cells, what cyclic AMP is used for is to activate an enzyme, which is called protein kinase A. So there are two arrows here and PKA. Now, there are two arrows here, but that doesn't mean there are two steps. What I meant is that cyclic AMP can go to many places in the cytoplasm, can diffuse through, and can find PKA wherever it happens to be. This is protein kinase, meaning that it adds phosphates to various proteins. Now, before we leave this, remember we said before, when you have a signal, you want to turn it on, but then you want to be able to turn it off. Now, once you get a signal and you make cyclic AMP, and the cyclic AMP activates an enzyme, activates a kinase, that kinase is going to go add phosphates to everything. How are we going to turn this off? How are we going to stop how are we going to stop this from continuing? Well, if there's no more signal, the receptor won't be activated, which means the G protein won't be activated. And remember, G proteins turn themselves off if they're not getting a signal. And so this enzyme won't be stimulated, and it won't make any new cyclic AMP. But how are we going to get rid of the cyclic AMP, which is already there? We need one more enzyme, and that's written on the bottom, where it says here, PDE. And you get plain old AMP. This is phosphodiesterase. And what it does is to break this connection on this side. So the phosphate ends up on the 5 prime, and we end up with plain, ordinary adenosine monophosphate. And that no longer has a signaling activity. So if we put this into our picture here, this is where phosphodiesterase acts to destroy the cyclic AMP second messenger. Now, there's the turnoff issue, but let's go back to the turn on. Suppose a hormone comes along, activates its receptor, activates the G protein, activates adenyl cyclase, we make cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP binds to protein kinase A and activates it. So now we have an active kinase. What is going to happen? What is going to happen is going to depend on what proteins we have in the cell. If this is the thyroid gland, the proteins for making thyroid hormone are present, and they will be phosphorylated, and they will act to make thyroid hormone. But I would like to talk about a different case, which was the first case to be discovered where cyclic AMP has an effect, and it's also an example where we can actually name the enzymes and not just say, well, all the enzymes get activated. And this example is on the other side of your handout, on 12B. Now, what I've done here is to rewrite, here is your handout, and you may notice that the top part is actually what we just wrote. It's just a different version or a different way of representing, which was on the top of 12A. And here, the hormone we're talking about is epinephrine. And its target cells, in this case, are liver or skeletal muscle. These two tissues store glycogen. And in response to epinephrine, they break down that glycogen. And we want to see how that works. Now, the beginning part's exactly what we had before. Epinephrine binds to its receptor. That activates its receptor. The receptor binds to the G protein. That causes the G protein to dump its GDP and pick up GTP. And now the active G protein activates adenyl cyclase. And the adenyl cyclase catalyzes production of cyclic AMP, and that cyclic AMP binds to PKA and activates it. So far, so good. We've just finished that part. But now, PKA, the kinase, is going to phosphorylate the enzymes involved in glycogen synthesis. So let's take a look at glycogen synthesis to see what's involved here. Glycogen is a polymer of glucose. And it's stored in liver cells and in skeletal muscle cells against the time when you might need energy. So extra glucose is polymerized using the enzyme glycogen synthetase to make this polymer. Now, when you need a burst of energy or when you haven't eaten for a long time, this polymer is broken down into monomers, as it happens, not into glucose, but to glucose-1-phosphate. And then these monomers can be broken down further by the pathways of energy metabolism to make ATP, etc. Now, how do you break down glycogen? You do that by using glycogen phosphorylase, which breaks the compound down and generates glucose-1-phosphate. So you have one enzyme here for glycogen synthesis and one enzyme for glycogen breakdown. Now, would you want these two enzymes to both work at the same time? If they did, you would have a futile cycle here. You would have a short circuit. You would basically use up ATP to make glycogen, and then you would lose the ATP breaking down the glycogen. So it would be, in fact, a big waste to run this futilely. And so cells don't. Cells have a system using cyclic AMP and pKa, which ensures that only one side or the other runs at any one time. And the trick to that is these two enzymes. Only one of these two enzymes is active at any one time. So if the synthetase is active, you make glycogen, and you store energy for a later day. If, on the other hand, phosphorylase is active, then you break down glycogen and make glucose. So how does that work? Let's go back to here. Epinephrine has led to the activation of protein kinase A. So protein kinase A now adds phosphates to various proteins. And two of those proteins are glycogen synthetase and phosphorylase kinase. Now, what are the effects of this? Remember, we said that a phosphorylated protein can be the active form or the inactive form. It turns out that one of these enzymes is activated by adding phosphate, and one of these enzymes is inhibited. The kinase is activated by adding phosphate. We know that from the arrow symbol. And the glycogen synthetase is inactivated by adding the phosphate. We know that from the blunt end symbol. This is the symbol for stimulation, and the other is the symbol for inhibition. Now, phosphorylase kinase itself is not involved in glycogen metabolism. It's a kinase, and it adds a phosphate to the actual enzyme, glycogen phosphorylase. So, as a result of adding epinephrine, making cyclic AMP, and activating the kinase, pKa, we now have phosphorylated glycogen phosphorylase and phosphorylated glycogen synthesis. Both of these enzymes have a phosphate on them. But adding a phosphate to phosphorylase activates it. And adding a phosphate to glycogen synthetase inactivates it. So what happens if the cyclic AMP is high? If the cyclic AMP is high, the kinases are high. And one kinase converts phosphorylase to its active form. And another kinase converts glycogen synthetase to its inactive do-nothing form. So what's going to happen now? We have inactive enzyme here, no reaction. We have active enzyme here, phosphorylase. So what's going to happen is glycogen is going to be broken down to glucose 1-phosphate. Now, does that make sense? Epinephrine is the stress hormone. It's what you produce if there's a pop quiz, lying in the street, etc. So in response to stress, you go through this process, you make cyclic AMP, and you activate protein kinase A. And what does that do to glycogen metabolism? It causes you to break down glycogen to glucose 1-phosphate. And that allows you to get energy that you need for the brain to think if it's a pop quiz, for your body to run away if, in fact, it's a lion. So that makes sense. This seems to be in the right direction. Now, let me just say a word about the difference between liver and skeletal muscle. Once you get glucose 1-phosphate, in most cells, it can be broken down for energy, but you can't release it into the blood. And that's, remember we said the phosphorylation traps the glucose in the cell. Because most cells have no enzyme for removing this phosphate. But liver, unlike almost all other cells, can convert the glucose 1-phosphate to glucose, and then it can go out to the blood and nourish then other, this glucose can be used to nourish other tissues other than the liver itself. Now, what happens when the pop quiz is over, or they catch the lion and put it back in the zoo? Well, you stop making epinephrine, so no longer activate receptor, no longer activate G protein. G protein turns itself off. No longer activated adenyl cyclase. We know what happens to cyclic AMP. Phosphodiesterase destroys it. And now, in the absence of cyclic AMP, pKa is no longer active. But if you look at the bottom of your picture, when cyclic AMP is low, not high, you activate a bunch of protein phosphatases. So you have two enzymes here. One puts phosphate on, one takes phosphate off. Kinases put it on, phosphatases take it off. So if you activate phosphatases now, that's going to reverse the state of the enzymes. If we didn't have the phosphatase, what would happen? Glycogen phosphorylase would stay active, and synthetase would stay inactive. But now along comes the phosphatase, and it takes off both phosphates. So when the cyclic AMP is low, the whole thing goes that way, meaning that glycogen synthetase is now dephosphorylated and activated, but phosphorylase is in fact deactivated when it loses its phosphate. So now it is synthesis which is favored. After the lion goes away, if you have extra glucose, you can now build it back up into glycogen and store it for the next crisis or after the next meal. Now, this example is fairly typical in that you have two processes, synthesis and degradation, which are balanced, and one takes place or the other at any particular time. So are there any questions about this before we go to the next example?
Is yeah. G protein mobile in the
bilayer,
or is it
migrating? Well, the pieces of the G protein stay in the bilayer, as far as I know. They stay in the membrane, but they can move laterally in the membrane.
So the way you draw them there is that these things are actually, there's a distance in between.
There actually is a distance. They can't be touching. Well, no, they're not quite right next to each other. That's correct. Yeah?
Which phosphates does the phosphatase remove?
The phosphatase removes phosphates from proteins.
Right.
That is the one we were talking about here, this one, the low cyclic AMP one. So it's going to remove phosphate both from these two enzymes, from phosphorylase, glycogen phosphorylase, and from glycogen synthetase. So it's the two bottom arrows that we're talking about. Any more questions? So we've already discussed with estrogen that the same hormone can get two different responses out of two different types of cells. And I want to talk now about how epinephrine gets three different responses out of three different types of cells. And we want to see how that works. Now, we've already explained one. We say that in liver and skeletal muscle, if you have epinephrine causes the liver and the skeletal muscle to break down glycogen. Now, epinephrine affects not one tissue, but many. That's one of the advantages of a hormone. It goes through the blood. It can hit many different target tissues and produce many effects at once. Epinephrine, in some smooth muscle, causes it to relax. In other smooth muscle, it causes it to contract. Now, what we want to consider is how you can get these three totally different responses from three different cell types or tissues. Now, maybe first we ought to ask, does this make any sense? We understand why, in that response to epinephrine, it would make sense to break down glycogen, give you glucose to have energy to respond. But why would any of the smooth muscle relax? Well, consider the smooth muscle, which is around your bronchioles. These are the very fine air sacs in your lung. The cells around your bronchioles, if they relax, will allow you to breathe in more deeply, have more area for exchange of oxygen, and will allow you to get in more oxygen and thereby get more energy and thereby run faster away from lion or think better on test. So it makes sense that the lung, the smooth muscle in the lung relaxes, allowing you to breathe more thoroughly and deeply. But why should any smooth muscle contract? Smooth muscle lines vesicles and tubes. Some smooth muscle lines your air passages, but other smooth muscle lines your blood vessels. The arterioles, didn't spell it right, are the very small, this isn't right either. It's too late at night. Arterioles. The very small arteries, the very small blood vessels, are surrounded by smooth muscle, and that can contract or relax, changing their diameter. Now, it is the arterioles in your peripheral circulation that contract in response to epinephrine. Now, the effect of that is that the small blood vessels in your arms and legs contract, and that pushes the blood away from your extremities to your major organs, so that your heart and liver get a good blood supply, and your brain. And this allows you, again, to respond better to the stress. So temporarily, you're reducing blood flow to your extremities and sending the blood to where it's really needed. So how is it possible to get these three different responses? For the first two, one and two, we actually know that you use the same receptor and the same G protein. And that means that you trigger exactly the same sequence of events down to protein kinase A. But after that, it must be different. So what could the difference be? Why don't you activate glycogen metabolism in these cells? Do these cells make glycogen? No. These cells don't have the enzyme either for making glycogen or breaking down glycogen. So you don't change glycogen metabolism because there isn't any. Similarly, these cells, liver cells, don't contract. So it's a completely different thing. The difference here is not the pathway of signaling, and it's not the kinase that's activated. What's different here is you have two different sets of protein targets for PKA. So one set of proteins gets phosphorylated in the liver and the skeletal muscle, and a completely different set of proteins gets phosphorylated in the smooth muscle. Now, how does phosphorylating proteins here lead to relaxation of the muscle? Now, in the notes it says, or the original version of the notes, it says that what PKA does is to add phosphate to a calcium pump. Contraction of muscle of all kinds requires calcium. So if the calcium pump is activated, then calcium will be removed from the cytosol and stored in the ER, which is where it normally is. So if calcium is removed back into the ER, there'll be a low level of calcium, and there will be no contraction. Now, this actually is not what happens in smooth muscle, but what happens to some extent in heart muscle. Calcium has multiple effects on heart muscle, and epinephrine changes many different aspects of that. And the net effect of epinephrine on heart muscle is actually to pump more and faster. This simply allows the heart muscle to relax more quickly so it can do another beat. But this is not what happens in the smooth muscle. What actually happens in the smooth muscle, and it says that now in the new version of the notes, is that what PKA actually phosphorylates is another kinase. Which is called MLCK. So it adds a phosphate to this. It is not the level of calcium that's changed by PKA action. It is the response to calcium which is changed in response to PKA action. And let me explain briefly what is happening here. In order for smooth muscle to contract, this kinase must work. What PKA does is to add a phosphate to it, and it's inactive. Now, this kinase is what responds to calcium. But if it's not working, it can't bind calcium and it can't do anything. So if the calcium is high and this kinase is active, the net result will be contraction. But if the kinase is inactive, the presence of calcium is irrelevant. Calcium can't stick to it, calcium can't do anything, and so you get no contraction. So what's going on here is PKA is knocking out, essentially, the protein that responds to calcium, and therefore the cells don't contract. They relax even though there is calcium present. So what's different between these two cell types is different proteins get phosphorylated, and therefore different reactions go faster or slower, and you get a completely different response in these two cell types to the same hormone. But what about the other two cases? What if I compare 2 with 3? Both of these are smooth muscle, which sounds sort of similar, like they ought to have the same proteins. And yet one of them relaxes in response to epinephrine, and one of them contracts. And it turns out that the difference here involves not just different target proteins, because actually they're sort of the same. The difference here is in the receptors and the G proteins which they activate. Receptors for epinephrine. Now, it turns out that many hormones have multiple receptors. In this case, these are called beta receptors, and on this cell, we have alpha 1 receptor. Different cell types can have different combinations of receptors for different hormones, and that can explain different reactions. The receptors from epinephrine were originally divided into beta and alpha, depending on their response to certain ligands. And then they've been subdivided even further as we learn more and more about their properties. So the two major types are beta and alpha, but alpha has subdivisions and beta has subdivisions. Now, these are different receptors. And as a result, each one binds to a different G protein. Now, we already know that the beta receptor is the one we've been talking about so far. Beta receptors trigger the activation of what's called G sub S. That is, they lead to activation of adenyl cyclase, the production of cyclic AMP, activation of PKA, et cetera, et cetera. But the alpha 1 receptor activates a different protein, G protein, which activates a different enzyme. And this is what's shown on the second panel of your handout on 12A, if you go back again. that the enzyme here is a different enzyme. The G protein is a different G protein, and the enzyme this time is phospholipase C, or PLC. Now, this is a lipase, which means instead of acting on ATP, it's going to act on lipid. It actually acts on a lipid which is in the membrane, which is called PIP2. And it breaks it down into two components that are called IP3 and DAG. DAG is lipid soluble, while it's written here in the membrane, while IP3 is water soluble, and therefore diffuses into the cytoplasm and acts as a second messenger in the same way that cyclic AMP does. Now, I want to go over the structure of this thing in a minute, but before I do that, let's consider, what is this for? What does it get done? IP3 does multiple things, but the major thing that it does is to bind to the ER. You'll notice in your picture, we've got a little bit of ER here. The ER stores calcium, and it has channels in the membrane. Now, as a result, if these channels are opened, you can get a pulse of calcium into the cytoplasm, and that can trigger some event. IP3 binds to receptors on the ER and opens or gates the channels. So when IP3 is released, that leads to the release of calcium in the cell. Some people consider calcium to be a third messenger. The first messenger is the hormone on the outside of the cell. The second hormone is the small molecule on the inside, either the cyclic AMP, the DAG, or the IP3. And then they consider calcium the next layer, or a third message. Other people just think of it as a second messenger, or it doesn't fit in the classification. Now, one of the things that calcium does is to trigger the contraction of muscle. So you can see here that the alpha receptor binds to a different G protein, which activates PLC, the lipase, instead of adenyl cyclase. And that generates IP3, and the IP3 causes release of calcium, and the calcium causes contraction. So what we have here are two different receptors triggering out two different second messenger pathways. Now, we have to take a few more details about this pathway. Before we leave this, I want to say something about calcium. That calcium by itself triggers many events. But calcium affects many proteins through forming a complex with a protein called calmodulin, whose name is written there. So it's often not calcium itself, but the calcium-calmodulin complex that binds to and activates other proteins. Yes, it says on your handout, either kinases or phosphatases. Now, in this picture, if protein lipase C does its thing, we actually get two second messengers, a soluble one and a lipid-soluble one, which means that we can activate two kinds of targets. And this DAG, diacylglycerol, whose structure we'll look at in a minute, actually activates another protein, which is usually found in or attached to the membrane. And this is called protein kinase C. There are actually three famous protein kinases that were discovered about the same time: protein kinase A, protein kinase B, and protein kinase C. And A is the one that is activated by cyclic AMP. B is involved in other processes, which we're not going to go into. And this is C. And this is also easy to remember, in that in some cases, PKC requires not only DAG to work, but also calcium. So this is another kinase on the long list, meaning that it is capable of adding phosphates to a series of proteins and thereby activating or inhibiting them. Now, what is this PIP2 thing and this DAG thing? You want to look at the bottom of your handout where the structures are written out. PIP2 is actually one of the lipids in the membrane. Here is a standard phospholipid. It has glycerol and two fatty acids. And then it has a phosphate. And for most phospholipids in the membrane, there is some alcohol here. And it varies what it is. And in this particular case, it's inositol. This is the head part. This is the lipid-soluble tail. Now, inositol is a six-membered ring, sort of like a sugar, but it's got all hydroxyls. So it has six positions on which you can put a phosphate. So this molecule appears to be very heavily involved in signaling because you can put one phosphate on it, two phosphates on it, three phosphates on it, four, five, or six. And if you have two, you can put them on one and three. You can put them in four and five. So the number of possible versions of this is very large. And therefore, it's probably used extensively in signaling because it can carry multiple different messages. The use of the other variants of inositol are currently a big area of investigation, but we're going to stick to this particular one, which was the first one to be discovered. And that is what's called PIP2 here. This is phosphatidyl inositol, or PI. What PIP2 has is two more phosphates. So one phosphate and a second, each added to one of the hydroxyls of inositol. And this is called PIP2 because it's phosphatidyl inositol plus two phosphates. It's also called phosphatidyl inositol bisphosphate and other things. Now, this is apparently formed. Phosphatidyl inositol is a pretty standard lipid. And what we've done here is to add two other phosphates to it by an enzyme, who we haven't specified. Still, the entire thing is stuck in the membrane until phospholipase C is activated. And then phospholipase C breaks the connection here. And what this leaves you with is the left half, which is glycerol with two fatty acids. And that's diacylglycerol, or DAG. But this part here is inositol with three phosphates, which is what's released into the cytoplasm, and that's usually called IP3, or INSP3. So this is the soluble part on the right and the insoluble part on the left. And each of them acts as a messenger to trigger either calcium release or activation of protein kinase C. So what we have here, then, our first two cases are the same receptor, same signaling pathway, but different target proteins. Our second two, our cases two and three, is very similar target proteins, but you have different receptors, different G proteins, and different signaling pathways. Now, I want to talk for just a minute about some of the medical consequences of all this. That if you look at this, could epinephrine be any use if you have asthma? What happens in asthma is you can't breathe because your arterioles are constricted. The muscle around them tightens. Would epinephrine help that? Absolutely. Epinephrine acting through beta receptors would, in fact, trigger cyclic AMP and the relaxation and opening up of your muscles, of your lung capacity. And epinephrine was originally used in inhalers exactly for this purpose. But the only trouble is that epinephrine stimulates not only your lungs to relax, but your heart to work faster. And so people looked for an analog of epinephrine that would stimulate your lungs to relax and leave your heart alone. And that is what they found, and that's what's now in inhalers. A very large number of drugs interact with these G protein coupled receptors. And the trick is always finding one that will activate one set and not another. And there are two kinds of drugs that interfere with receptors. One kind is a mimic of the natural hormone, like what's in an inhaler, in that it binds to the receptor and triggers activation. And that's called an agonist. An agonist is a mimic of a hormone or a signal molecule. It binds to the receptor and activates the receptor. The alternative is an antagonist. An antagonist actually blocks the effects of the normal ligand. And the way an antagonist works is it binds to the receptor, but it doesn't activate it. So it essentially jams the receptor and prevents the normal signal molecule, the normal ligand, from binding. And so it prevents stimulation of the pathway. And a very large number of drugs are either agonists or antagonists of G protein coupled receptors. Now I'm going to stop here. That's what I wanted to cover today. And all of this will be on exam one, but what happens on Tuesday will not. But on Thursday. But on Thursday, Dr. Heiklin will be talking about how you set up cells that have different sets of proteins. How does development happen in the first place so that you have differentiated cells ready to respond differently?
The last two classes will have